I'm John Kroll. Coming up on No Limits, we'll talk about the do's and don'ts of lobbying. The role of lobbyists in forming public policy always has generated discussion. But that discussion got fresh legs in the most recent election when Senator Dan Coats' tenure as a lobbyist became campaign fodder for his opponents. We'll talk about what lobbying is, what it should be, and what it shouldn't be with Common Cause's Julia Vaughn, lobbyist Dan Seitz, former State Representative David Orentlicher, and you. We'll take your calls toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, your emails at nolimits@wfyi.org, and your questions and comments via Twitter or Facebook at WFYI. Please do join this conversation on lobbying and lobbyists. But first, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today about lobbying and lobbyists, what they do, what they should do, what they shouldn't do. And we're fortunate to have as our guests today Julia Vaughn, who is the policy director for Common Cause of Indiana. Julia, welcome to the program. Good to have you here. Glad to have you here. Dan Seitz, who is the managing principal with Bowes Public Affairs. Dan, good to have you here. Thanks for joining us. And former Representative David Orentlicher, who is on the phone with us. David, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Thank you for joining us. We should start. I should start this program with a disclosure of sorts, in the interest of full disclosure, and just let my audience know that I, in fact, was a registered lobbyist myself for about 6 years. So I may talk with a little bit less journalistic detachment than I normally do on this subject. I think to get us started, I'd like to talk a little bit about the role of the lobbyist, what a lobbyist is. It's one of those terms that gets thrown around an awful lot, and you find out that people are operating with greatly different definitions. Dan, since you are the one who lobbies probably more than anybody else, could you talk a little bit about how you see your role and what function you perform?
Sure. I think the role of the lobbyist is as a facilitator, and in other words, facilitating communication between policymakers and various organizations or groups that have an interest in the outcome of that public policy. There are two things that you have to do. One is you have to communicate with respect to the policy itself, the pros and cons. And I stress that you have to talk about both sides of an issue. You can't go in and just sandbag a legislator by only talking about your view of the issue and totally ignoring the other side. You have to address all of the issues. The second thing you have to do is help that legislator or group of legislators who have an interest in your position and moving that position. You have to help them procedurally in kind of being their assistant in tracking where things are, because legislators have so many issues that they're dealing with on a daily basis and so many bills that they have to track. Sometimes bills get lost simply because of inattention. And so that I think those two things are key.
Julia, what is a lobbyist from your perspective?
Well, I agree with Dan that they play a critical role in the legislative process in terms of providing information, particularly providing information to legislators. Now, I tend to think of it as more one-sided than Dan explained. But, you know, the problem, and they're integral to the process in terms of providing information. There isn't any way, particularly in a state like Indiana where our legislature is part-time, there just isn't any way for these policymakers to be experts on every issue. So I think that lobbyists play an absolutely critical role in providing information and education to legislators. Where I have problems is when they start providing more than that. And in Indiana, we have a system where lobbyists can give to legislators gifts and things of value. There are no limits on the gifts, the value that they can give. And, you know, so things like taking them out to dinner, playing golf, you know, just lavishing things of value upon legislators really creates the appearance of impropriety. And don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that anybody's vote is bought for a $100 dinner at St. Elmo's. I'm not suggesting that. But what the gifts and the things of value enable certain lobbyists to do is build relationships with individual legislators. And that's incredibly important. One of the things that I really didn't understand before I started this process and became a lobbyist was how important relationships are. You know, the deal is we are all human beings in this process. And the way that human beings are wired, if you feel good about somebody, if you feel friendly, if you think they are your buddy, you are far more likely to do things for them than if you don't feel good about them. So that's the problem I have with the millions and millions of dollars that are spent by some lobbyists every year, is that they get the opportunity to build close, friendly relationships with legislators that I and many of my colleagues who don't have the sort of lobbying budgets, but more importantly, that the legislators' constituents aren't able to build those close, friendly relationships. So, you know, providing information, that's vital to the process. That is what we believe lobbyists should be doing. It's when you start spending the money, it's where we draw the line.
And we're going to talk at some length about the role that money plays in the process, and that is a multifaceted issue that we'll devote some significant time to. Former Representative David Orentlicker, your view on what a lobbyist is or should be.
Yeah, you know, Dan and Julia have emphasized really important points. Lobbyists serve an important informational role. As Julia observed, legislators are part-time, part-year. You have to deal with issues from health care to telecommunications regulation to coal mining and hog farming, and you can't possibly master all of those by yourself. And so there's an important information gap, and lobbyists are quick to fill it. And often it's very helpful information, and sometimes it's not, sometimes it is. They provide a very important oversight function. If lobbyists didn't attend committee meetings, the room might be empty other than the legislators, and it's important that what legislators do is not behind closed doors, that the public is aware of it, and somebody, often it's the media, but lobbyists play an important role in making sure that what legislators, the business they conduct, is observed by the public. But the other important point that Julia made is the one about relationships. She's exactly right that personal relationships are very important in life, and especially in the legislative process. And I remember when I was first elected and I met with one of the senior legislators for guidance, and she said the most important thing for you to understand is it's all about relationships. And so the advice I got was to make a special point of developing personal relationships myself with other legislators, whether across the aisle or in the Senate, because if I were going to get my bills passed, I needed 50 other representatives and 26 senators, and if I had a good personal relationship with them, they would be much more likely to support my bills. But the money part is, and as Julia said, that's where the money comes in. You're more likely to develop a personal relationship with somebody who takes you out to dinner or to some other functions, and it does have an corrupting effect on the process.
Well, it sounds like we are coming to the money question pretty quickly in the program. It sounds like Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana. What role does money play in this process, in the lobbying process? And then Dan, I'm going to throw it back to you. Dan cites.
I think it plays a huge role. If you, you know, just look at the statistics, millions and millions of dollars are spent by lobbyists in Indiana during a, you know, really short period of time. We have a very short legislative session, and that's when the bulk of the money is spent. As I said, you know, if I can take you to a Pacers game or I can take you out to dinner, then that gives me, you know, a lot of uninterrupted time to talk to you about my issue. And again, just to get to know you. And you're going to, you know, when I call you and leave a message, then, you know, my message is going to rise to the top. You're going to return my call before you are others because, you know, I'm your friend. You feel good about me. So I think the money, you know, our system in Indiana is completely disclosure-based. We don't really prohibit anything outside of outright bribery. You know, you can't offer any legislator anything of value for their vote. And I don't think that happens because you don't need to do that. It's a disclosure-based system. We let you do whatever you want, but just tell us a little bit something about, you know, what you spent, who you spent it on. You know, it's not a very good disclosure-based system. We get this information after the legislature has already adjourned and gone home. Disclosure is most useful when it's timely. And so while the legislature earlier this year did pass some good lobbying reforms, they really didn't address one of the fundamental problems in that, you know, the public gets this information about what was spent during the session long after the session is over. And so more timely disclosure would be very useful, just in terms of, you know, figuring out who's talking to whom.
Before I throw this back to Dan Seitz of Bose Public Affairs, I'm going to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881 or sending questions via email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can send questions or comments via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. Dan, what role does money play in what you do?
Well, there is no doubt, and Julie is correct, relationships are everything. Part of the way you build relationships is to, in one case or one sense, break bread, because it is time that you have uninterrupted to, as she points out, to talk to a legislator. On the other hand, my own personal view is fairly cautious about how I go about doing that. In most cases, I do not do it over lunch, breakfast, dinner, or at a Pacers game. I try to find time to sit down with legislators. And part of that, I will confess, is the fact that this is my 39th session coming up, and frankly, I'm tired of sitting with some of these people any longer than I have to.
Okay.
But let's define some terms. The millions and millions of dollars that Julie talked about is misleading because most of that is not expended on gifts or entertainment. It's expended on salaries, and all of that data is reported. Second, the definition of a gift. A gift is something I give to you, and then I walk away. So if I give you two tickets to a Pacers game, you go to the game, that's a gift. If I go with you to the game, the definition of that is entertainment, and we report that differently. So gifts get reported in a very short time frame if they exceed $50 now, mm-hmm. under the new law. The entertainment, as Julie points out, doesn't really get reported until every 6 months we have to file a report and disclose all of our expenditures. So she's correct in that regard. But we do have a disclosure state. It is based on transparency. My own personal view is I would not lose sleep if we did away with gifts entirely. I would not lose sleep if we put heavy restrictions on entertainment, because I still believe, as she points out, it's about relationships, and you can build relationships in a lot of different ways.
We are talking about the role of lobbyists and lobbying in driving public policy. Our guests are Julia Vaughn, who is the public policy director for Common Cause Indiana, Dan Seitz, who is the managing principal with Bose Public Affairs, and former State Representative David Orrant Licker. I would like to invite our callers, to our listeners, to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending your comments via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. We will be talking more about the role of money in public policy. You are listening to No Limits. I'm John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today about lobbying and lobbyists with Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana, Dan Seitz, Bose Public Affairs, and former State Representative David Orrant Licker. We've been talking really about the role of money in the process, and I guess, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, I spent 6 years as a lobbyist myself. And I think I'd like to broaden that subject a little bit. My perception from my experience then was that in addition to establishing the relationship, money played a role in the amount of access that you got. I was a lobbyist when I was the executive director for the Civil Liberties Union here in Indiana, and I found that somehow I seem to have more access to members of the state legislature after we had a lot of fundraising success while I was there. The fact that there were people of means who were, in effect, standing behind the organization meant that in effect, we were taken more seriously, that there was more credibility there. It's not an issue that's going to show up on any of the reports that we're talking about because we weren't giving gifts. But it demonstrated, at least to the legislators, it seemed to, that we were more serious because of it. Julia Vaughn, you're nodding your head right now in affirmation. Do you want to speak to that a little bit?
I think that lobbying is like a lot of, you know, other areas in our society. Money buys you credibility. It, you know, makes you seem more than what you are sometimes. And having the right connections is important because, you know, we are talking about politics is the thing that, you know, hangs over all of this. I think the other thing that I've certainly noticed is important is not just, you know, connections, who is part of your organization, who's a bigwig, or, you know, what is your bottom line budget, but it's, do you have the election and campaign side of your organization as well? I mean, certainly there are groups like ISTA on the Democrat side and the Chamber of Commerce on the other side who, you know, go out, recruit candidates, pretty much run campaigns, and, you know, have the ability that if they're not agreeing with you, if you get on the wrong side of ISTA, the wrong side of the chamber, you can have a primary opponent, you know, come the spring election, or have a well-funded opponent in the general. So there's that other, I think the public a lot of times doesn't recognize that a lot of your bigger lobbying organizations have this election and campaign side that they use to control legislators. You know, don't step out of line or we're going to recruit somebody and we'll be able to fund them to run against you. So that's an extremely powerful tool some folks use.
Dan Seitz, and then I want to get David Orrant Licker in on this, too.
I guess the only thing I would object to is the use of the word control them. Even in those situations where a lot of money is poured in, are they truly controlled or are they not? If you look, I mean, I'm not as familiar with the State Teachers Association as I am with the chamber because I happen to sit on the chamber board. Mm-hmm. But there's a very elaborate process that goes into rating all of these individuals and assigning them certain marks for how they voted on key legislation all through the process. And so when they evaluate where they're going to put their dollars and who they may decide to go after, there is all this data that's been built up. And what's amazing is that notwithstanding the fact that that is the process, and many of these people know that that's going to be the process, many of the elected people. That doesn't mean, if you look at their scores, they don't always, you know, they don't just lie down every time. Now, it might be from the chamber viewpoint, we wish they did, but I don't think the control is quite as strong as you think, because I think what you get is you get like-minded thinking in terms of there's a certain, feeling going in that I believe in certain things, and so you line up
I hear
from some legislators that they feel the pressure. I mean, you know, I just came from a meeting with somebody who got targeted by the chamber in his primary, and apparently his voting record was 82% in favor of the chamber. So he's still trying to, you know, figure out what he did wrong. But I can tell you that certain legislators, I'm sort of like the priest at the General Assembly. I often have people come up and want to do a confession with me. And they, will just complain, you know, so-and-so's coming after me and I don't know what to do. They're threatening to run an opponent against me in the primary. So certainly, you know, it might be not be the perception among the organization, but I can tell you some individual legislators have definitely felt the heat.
I don't disagree with that.
Yeah, and let's poll actually our former legislator here, David Ortlinger, who could speak with authority on that. David, how much pressure do legislators feel?
Different organizations can have tremendous influence, and part of it is the money they have, and part of it is the fact that they represent a broad constituency. The Teachers Association represents a huge number of teachers who vote and are active in the political process, and the chamber also has a broad constituency. So when an organization comes that you know is going to be important in the electoral process because it has the money and it can influence a lot of voters organizations that carry weight, are opinion leaders in their community. And yes, it really matters. I'll give some examples. One of my colleagues, I remember, before various different votes, would pull out the chamber would issue a voting guide, and here are the bills they cared about, and here are their preferred vote, and he would pull it out to see what they wanted before he voted. Now, I don't know to what extent it influenced his vote, but it was the only voting scorecard I saw him pull out during the legislative session, and people pay attention. Having a chamber endorsement is important, and so that legislators will care about how they can secure the chamber endorsement or how they can secure the Teachers Association endorsement. The other thing I wanted to illustrate how influential the organizations are in the political process. One of the terms that we use in the state house is that legislators carry bills. You don't hear people say legislators so much draft or introduce bills. You hear them talk about legislators carrying bills, and that's because so many bills are written by the different interest groups, and then the legislator will carry them, and like carrying water, I suppose. And you go to it's not uncommon in a committee hearing for a legislator who's authoring the bill. The bill's heard, the legislator will speak for a couple minutes, and then ask a lobbyist for an interest group that's behind the bill to then discuss the bill. And often the lobbyist knows far more about the bill than the legislator, and that's troublesome. I think my sense was that about half the bills that were filed in any given legislative session, it didn't matter whether you had a Republican majority or Democratic majority. The only thing that would change with a change in power and control was whether the lead author would be a Democrat or Republican. But they'd be half the bills would be essentially the same. So the interest groups have a huge amount of influence. Some of it's money. Some of it's because they do represent a large constituency. And so if the realtors come, and there are lots of realtors out there who are active in the political process, and so the Realtors Association is representing a lot of voters. That's important, and so you take that into account.
We're talking about lobbying and lobbyists with Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana, Dan Seitz with Bowes Public Affairs, and former State Representative David Orentlicker. We actually have started getting some questions and some tweets. I'm going to take one of them right now. We got an email from Chad Crabtree, who's apparently listening up in South Bend. I did not know we reached that far. Glad we do. And his question is a pretty basic one. What defines a lobbyist versus a concerned active citizen who communicates on a regular basis with their legislator? I guess I probably also would say, at what point do you actually have to register as a lobbyist?
A lobbyist is an individual who is seeking to influence legislation or public policy and is paid for it. And the minimum payment, the threshold for registration, I believe, is $1,500.
$500.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. $500. It's been so long since I've had to deal with that.
You crossed that threshold in the first five minutes, Dan.
I just register. You know? I don't even think about it anymore. So if you are paid more than $500 on an issue, so the citizens of the world are free to come in. They're free to reach out to their legislators. In fact, the best place for them to reach their legislators is when they're at home on the weekends, because there are all kinds of forums that are available all over the state for that kind of communication.
Yeah. Let me get
back to a
point Julia made about legislators.
Please, David Orentlicker.
Likely to return a lobbyist call. I would return, you know, if a constituent came in and had a question, I would be just as likely to, and maybe more likely if it's actually a constituent calling with a question, I'll meet with them too. The problem is constituents often aren't able to be there when we're doing our business, when legislators are doing their business. It's during the weekday when most people are working. Lobbyists are paid. It's their job to come down. So they're able to be there and make the connections that other people just aren't in the position to make, even though if they could be there Monday through Thursday 9 to 5, they'd be listened to and legislators would take the time. But it's just so hard if it's not your job to be there to take the time and be involved in the process.
One of the positive things
that's happened, and
I think Julie would agree with this, is we've got greater transparency now for the public. Finally, we're starting to get hearing rooms wired for sound and video, and so those are streamed live. You can go to indiana.gov and go to the Indiana General Assembly and call up various rooms. And the nice thing that I heard from the new speaker, Bosma, is that they're going to finish wiring all of their rooms, which hasn't been the case. I think the Senate is now fully wired, but the House has not been. I think that's very good for the public.
Do you agree, Julia?
Oh, yeah. We've been supportive of webcasting for a long time. The original bill that set it up was one that we pushed for. So, yeah, it's a good thing. But and certainly I agree that, you know, when legislators are home in the home districts, when they're not in session, it really is the best time for people to, again, build those relationships, because that's what's so important. But frankly, you know, we encourage folks to come down, you know, watch your legislature in action, because it really can be very interesting, very educational, but it is not a place that's really friendly to the public participating in that way. I mean, I'll be thrilled if they actually have microphones in all of the committee rooms. You know, there are some legislators who have perfected the mumble, and you know, you can be right in the room with them and you can't understand what they're saying. So it's a difficult, you know, building to get around in. It's vast. If you don't know where places are, it's easy to get lost. One of the things that really honks me off are these lobbying firms that have a million employees. They all send their interns to save seats, and so there's often not any seats available. Things never start on time. You know, we have this time that we refer to as legislative time. Mm-hmm. It's about 20 minutes behind the real time. And, you know, I've invited people to come before, and they have waited around for hours, and they they've ended up getting angry and stomped off and told me, don't ever ask me to come back to this place again. You know, it's not the real world. I hate it. So
you're beginning to make an argument here for why people have to be paid to do this.
I was going to comment on that, but I've always been surprised that the Civil Liberties Union has never brought suit on a constitutional challenge to impairment of freedom of speech based on the physical assets that are provided for these hearings, because these hearing rooms are atrocious. They are tiny. And as Julia said, and even those that don't mumble, if you're four rows back in some of these rooms, you cannot hear what's going on at the table.
Well, and some of that is obviously it was a... It's a building that was built in the 19th century when broadcast was but a dream and all of that, so that the sound doesn't carry. We've got a question here that I think is going to lead us into a larger discussion. It's a tweet from Ben who really, I think, is going to start us on the whole revolving door question, where he says, from an earning standpoint, is it better to start as a politician then become a lobbyist, or the other way around? Obviously, some reference that issue got its freshest legs in the last campaign when Dan Coats had spent some time as a lobbyist before returning to the Senate. Could we talk a little bit about, and I know it's an issue for Common Cause, the idea of the revolving door, legislators becoming lobbyists and then perhaps becoming legislators again?
Yeah, that one swung really quick for Dan Coats. But, yeah, usually, you know, the thing we worry about is legislators becoming lobbyists. Again, the public policy concern for us is that people are using public service to, you know, enrich themselves privately. You always got to worry about, you know, was somebody angling for a job and a key vote came up and they voted one way or the other trying to please the prospective employer. So we were real excited when the General Assembly decided to pass a one-year cooling off period. We'll be even more excited when it actually takes effect next year. You know, that was the key thing, I think, to actually making it through the legislative process, was that it doesn't take effect until, and it gives current legislators the out. If they choose to go through the revolving door, they still have time to do it. But it was the right thing to do. I'm not sure that 1 year is the right amount of cooling off. I think it's really interesting that in Minnesota, they currently have a 3-year cooling off period, and they're contemplating a 5-year cooling off period. So obviously, they've got a different political culture up there. But the 1-year cooling off period, it's a good idea. We'll be glad when it goes into effect. I expect we will still see a few more people slip through that revolving door and leave the General Assembly to become lobbyists before it does take effect.
Is experience as a legislator valuable as a lobbyist, would you say, Dan Seitz?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And you know, I don't disagree with what Julia said about it in terms of, you know, it does provide an opportunity for conduct that may not be the best for the people that are represented by that legislator. You know, I'm a mea culpa. I mean, I've got a partner who is the former Speaker of the House. I've got a legislator who just retired this past summer. We are voluntarily not registering and not allowing that individual to lobby through this session, which, frankly, is difficult because this is the long session, and this is when you need your greatest resources. But we felt that the spirit of the of what had been adopted should be lived with, and we've tried to do that.
You are listening to No Limits. We are talking about lobbying and lobbyists with Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana, Dan Seitz from Bose Public Affairs, former Representative David Orrin Licker. I'm John Krall. We're going to talk a little bit more about the role of relationships in shaping public policy. Please stay with us. Good afternoon. I'm John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and the host of No Limits, which you are listening to now. We're talking about lobbying and lobbyists, the legislature. Our guests today are Julia Vaughn, Common Cause Indiana, Dan Seitz, Bose Public Affairs, and David Orentlicker, former state representative. David Orentlicker, could you talk a little bit about whether that whole revolving door question? I mean, should legislators be allowed to become lobbyists when they leave? Should there be a cooling off period? If so, how long should it be?
Yeah, there definitely should be a cooling off period. I understand why it happens. When we're a part-time legislature, and so the theory is you can maintain your job while you're serving, but that just doesn't work very well. And so somebody, I can see how it happens easily. You've been serving a long time. You might have had to give up your job, or you've had difficulty maintaining it. So where do you go after you've been a legislator? What are your opportunities? And being a lobbyist is one of the better ones. So, you know, given the nature of service, it's not surprising it happens, but it really isn't fair to the public. As Julia said, it gives legislators an opportunity to use their public service for private gain. And we've seen examples of people in public service who have made decisions because they were eyeing a job in the private sector, and that distorts the political process unfairly. And then they can use the personal relationships they developed, as we've talked in a number of ways. Personal relationships matter so much. And so if you're a former legislator, you have one of the best personal relationships with legislators, and you're going to have more of an open door. You can go on the floor more easily than anybody else can. So you're going to be able to leverage your public service in a way that just other people can't, and that's not, and that compromises the fairness of the process. And so, you know, if Minnesota has a 3-year, I'm thinking of a 5-year cooling off period, they're going in the right direction. 1 year just isn't sufficient because, you know, you can buy your time for a year, and a lobbying firm is probably willing to pay for a year and find something for you to do, even if you aren't actively lobbying. There are other things, advice you can provide, and then once that year is over, you're in a position to then take full advantage of your prior service.
Well, and I guess I'll step in and ask a question here where really what I wonder if part of the issue here is the nature of our legislature here. I mean, the part-time aspect of it, because I think that is a piece people don't get, that these folks, by and large, have to disappear from their jobs for a minimum of 2 months, sometimes as long as 4 or 5, and if we go to a special session, you know, suddenly have to take time off. Does that build in, you know, more opportunities for distortion? I don't want to use a much more loaded word than that into the process. I'll throw this one back to former Representative David Orentlicker first. Would the state be better served by having a full-time legislature?
I think it would be. It wouldn't solve the revolving door problem, because then if you're full-time, you really had to abandon any other employment. But it would solve a lot of other problems. You know, two things. One, full-time, because you are trying to, you know, get up to speed on different bills when you have a very short session. And so how can you vote knowledgeably on hundreds of bills in a few months period? So it's giving more time to think and deliberate, but also having more of a staff. I think that's another huge part about it. If, you know, when I was a legislator and I wasn't sure about an issue, I shared a legislative assistant with 2 or 3 other legislators, and that person had to answer phone calls, respond to mail, do copying. And so the idea that I could ask the person to do research and write a memo was just not realistic. And, you know, we have there's a legislative services agency that, to some extent, I was lucky because as a professor, I could turn to my colleagues at the university and get advice, but most legislators can't do that. So having a staff, so you don't have to turn to lobbyists for your information. You can turn to a staff member and say, you know, we've got this health care bill coming up or this telecommunications bill. You know, do some research and write me a memo. And so, yes, I think a full-time legislature and a staff would help a lot. Whether it would solve the problem when you look at Congress, where you have that kind of a structure, it doesn't seem that lobbyists are any less.
Dan Seitz is smiling right now, so I'm going to let him jump in.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, well, if you like Congress, then you'll love a full-time legislature here in Indiana. You know, there are all kinds of issues that relate to that. You got to pay a living wage to these people. If you pay well enough, they're never going to leave their office, and is that good? That we've got people, you're going to put in term limits. I mean, how are you going to deal with all these other collateral issues that affect whether we are efficient in making good public policy decisions? I'd say we're pretty remarkable. I've got a lot of experience having worked in many other states for many years, and full-time legislatures tend to be bureaucratic. They tend to not necessarily this idea that if I've got staff, I'll have better information is not true. Unless you're hiring the staff from the industry that you're going to be talking about, and then, gee, is that right? I mean, they're not independent. So, I mean, there's so many issues involved in that. I don't think it's a simple fix. I understand folks that feel that way, and I understand particularly the lack of support that and support staff that our folks have, and that is a problem.
Julia Vaughn, you're
you know, I think there's got to be some sort of middle ground between a full-blown bureaucratic full-time legislative body and a 30-day short session. I was talking to somebody in Illinois yesterday, and I happened to mention that, well, you know, the session was only 30 days this year. And she said, what? I mean, we have some pretty complicated problems that I just don't think you're ever going to get a really good resolution to in 30 and then 60 days for a long session. So, you know, I'm not sure that year-round is the solution, but I do feel that things get really, really rushed. And David's point about not having an independent entity to do any research, I think that's why legislators get so dependent on lobbyists. But I do know that 30 and 60-day sessions really fly by, and I think we get just there's this rush to get something done, and it's not always the best work product that it could be.
And the other thing about a short session,
David Orentlicker, yeah, please.
Yeah, the other part about it is, you know, in the year-round, whether it's a city, county council, or a Congress, that means you can introduce bills at any particular time during the year, except as you're getting close to the end. But with our short session, that legislators have to file bills. You know, there's this window, December, January, where you file bills. Now, you can amend other bills if you don't make the filing deadline, but it really concentrates the bill introduction process into a very narrow window, and ideas come up other times during the year. And so you end up with the legislative services people getting flooded with requests rather than in one month period, especially, and for them, it's over their, you know, the holidays when they'd like to be with their families. So that makes it even worse. But it'd be nice if you could spread a lot of this work over a year's time period, and then people, somebody mentioned, I think Dan, about bills getting lost because there's so much an avalanche in a short period of time, and things are less likely to get lost if they're not all compressed into a very short period of time.
Of course, there's a difference between when you can introduce a bill and when you can produce the bill. Mm-hmm. There is no prohibition from a legislator going in June to the legislative services and saying, I want you to draft me a bill.
Yeah.
Now, I can't introduce it until Organization Day, which is in November. But
and we've gotten a question that I want to take up. I think this is a real quick answer one. Are there more lobbyists than legislators out there?
Yes.
Mm. Yes.
By a big market.
Do we have an idea how many there are registered out there in the state? Do you know?
The last number that I saw was between 900 and 1,000. I've also, there have been years.
And there are 150 legislators.
And 150 legislators. And there have been years when there are as high as 1,200. There have been years. But the reality is there are a lot of people that register. And there are really only a much smaller number, still in excess of the number of legislators, but not by a huge amount. I mean, maybe, well, huge amount. It could be double. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying the people that are active, it's below 300, I would guess.
We've got a caller I'm going to bring into the conversation. Greg, you're calling from Indianapolis. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. What's your question?
It's a pretty straightforward question. I've heard in the past that on a federal basis that lobbyists are allowed to write legislature. Is that true in Indiana or not?
Julia Vaughn's nodding her head. Julia Vaughn of Common Cause.
Well, it's sort of what we talked about. I think David was talking about, you know, most bill drafts, I don't think, are the original ideas of the legislator who takes them to legislative services. I think they came from an interest group, many times a lobbying group. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's the lobbyist who will take this idea for legislation to a legislator. A citizen cannot go, or a lobbyist cannot go to legislative services and have them draft a bill. You have to have a legislator do that. But, yeah, most of the drafts come from somebody who's getting paid to influence the process.
And yeah, Dan Sykes, an is that something
that's,
you do?
That's true, and except that in a lot of cases there are many organizations that are industry-related, such as the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. They produce model legislation. So, yeah, I'll bring a draft, but it's not my draft. I didn't draft it. It was drafted as a model bill. And I go to LSA with a legislator to talk to them about it, with the legislator or the legislator's assistant, because I cannot communicate directly with LSA. And I may explain the bill to the draft person that this is what is intended. I will guarantee you invariably it is not my bill when it comes back drafted, because the LSA tends to draft it in different ways than
they have a freelance attitude. Yeah. I'll agree.
Right. David Orentlicker, you had a point you wanted to make.
Yeah, I think just to illustrate how important lobbyists are in drafting bills, I gave the examples of how common it is for a legislator to defer to a lobbyist to explain a bill, and it's not unusual for the lobbyist to answer most of the questions. And even to the extent I recall when I was when I was in public health and I was debating with the representative of one of the trade associations that was supporting the bill about one of the terms, and you know, based on my experience as a physician, I thought we should use a different term than was in the bill, and we were going back and forth, and one of my colleagues and another representative interrupted and said, pointing to the lobbyist, "Well, we should go with his term because it's his bill." And I was thinking, his bill?
Poor choice of words there.
But it, you know, is very revealing, and you know, that's, you know, an unfortunate reality that these issues are very complicated as part of it. That gets to the lack of expertise. It gets to the influence that the different groups have. But they write the bills, and often only they understand them well enough to explain them and respond to questions.
That's true, because there's an awful lot of legislation that is so hugely technical in nature. And I'll tell you, the worst time for a lobbyist is on second and third reading, when you're standing at the window watching your sponsor of your bill try to explain that bill. And too many times they are unable to explain it, and I don't care how much time you spent, because I spend a lot of time before that trying to make sure they do understand all the aspects of the bill, but it's just so much information they cannot, you know, they're not in a position to retain it by the...
Well, you often see legislators running out of the chamber up to a lobbyist. Where are my talking points?
Yeah.
My bill's coming up on second reading. I can't explain it. Give me the talking points. So, you know, at a certain point, the legislator is kind of the figurehead. They're the official person who has the ability to introduce and vote, but it's the person outside in the lobby. It's their bill. They own it. They wrote it. They're pushing for it, and it is their bill.
Yeah. Let me give another phenomenon.
Yeah, please, David Orentlicker.
Not unusual, and when you're in a committee, there will be a bill that perhaps one association or interest group wrote, and there'll be other interest groups that disagree with it. And the committee chair will see the disagreement developing and will say effectively or explicitly, you know, if you all can agree, we'll move this bill forward, but I'm going to table this until you can come to some agreement. And so if the different interest groups can work out a bill that they're all comfortable with, then the committee will take it up again and move it forward. So that's another way where the interest groups really end up being the ones who shape the legislation.
Who is Julia Vaughn, David Orentlicker? I'm gonna take Dan out of this because he might have a self-interest in it. Who is the most powerful lobbyist in the state of Indiana?
Dan Seitz,
Julia Vaughn. All right. Well, now that you've stroked him,
yeah, really.
There are several. I mean, you know, traditionally the chamber is, you know, and I don't want to name individuals because you know I have to go down there, but certainly the chamber is a big important organization. ISTA, on the other, you know, side of the spectrum, has been extremely important as well. So they are, I'd say, the two 800-pound gorillas on both sides.
David Orentlicker.
I would agree with Julian. I'll give you an illustration with the chamber.
Got a little bit less than a minute left.
Yeah, so. I had a labor bill and got it through the House, and I, you know, went to meet the committee chair in the Senate to, you know, seek a hearing. And I was also told that I also should see a lobbyist from the chamber because the chair in the Senate would defer to the lobbyist from the chamber in setting the agenda for the committee hearings.
Julia Vaughn, Dan Seitz, David Orentlicker, thank you very much for joining us. I've enjoyed this conversation. We're going to be back next week for next Thursday's No Limits, when we're going to be talking about the state of the arts in Indiana. Look forward to talking with you then. Make it a good week. Until then, I'm John Kroll, your host. I'll look forward to talking with you again 7 days from now.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. Board Engineers, Matt Sosi and Josh Hamig. And intern, Savannah Rains. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, and you can listen online at WFYI.org.